Good evening, everyone. Welcome to On the Line. It's great to be back with you this week after missing last week. We got a special guest with us this week, Aaron Bandler. Welcome to On the Line.
Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us for the first time this week is Lone Conservative team member, Carlos Chavez.
Hey, how you guys doing?
And as always, Rob Sasso.
Alec, it's great to be back as always.
And like Rob said, I'm Alec. I'm your host. And we're going to be getting into it real quick tonight, jumping straight in with the whole new stuff on Russia. We're all getting tired of it, but it keeps coming back. Honestly, I don't know how the mainstream media keep talking about this just because I'm so bored of it by now. So, Aaron, maybe you can give us some fresh insight onto the Russia story.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just sitting with you that there's a lot of Russia fatigue going on there, going on right now. I think some voters feel that way too. So, but latest news this week. So basically what happened is it became revealed that Donald Trump Jr. had this meeting with an attorney who supposedly was working with the Russian government. And everybody starts shouting, treason, lock him up. But I think everybody who says that needs to like take a step back and just sort of like take a deep breath and look at the facts, because he gets this email from Rob Gladstone. You know, he's a tabloid journalist, and he's the one saying that this Russian attorney works for the Russian government, and that she has opposition research dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, I don't think we know for sure yet that this attorney was actually working with the Russian government or not, because that's just what Gladstone said. I mean, there's no other concrete proof. In fact, Eric Erickson had a very lengthy post in The Resurgent where he basically outlined all these various Democrat ties that this attorney has, and she was also let into the United States by Obama's Justice Department under extraordinary circumstances and stayed beyond her waiver. So, you know, I'm not one of those people who thinks that she's a Democrat plant, but I mean, clearly there's a lot more to her that we don't know yet. That's what I'm saying. But even still, he goes to this meeting with under the auspices that she's a Russian government attorney. And what happened? I mean, really nothing. I mean, there was no opposition researcher given to him, at least none that we know of. And all she did was lobby to repeal the Magnitsky Act, which is basically this act that levied sanctions against 18 Russian individuals who were involved in like this big tax fraud scheme. And she was one of them. And that law is still in place. So, I mean, That doesn't even prove collusion, let alone that crime was committed. And so really, I think at worst is that meeting shows that Donald Trump Jr. was willing to engage in sleazy politics. That's it. I mean, that's certainly not a good thing. We shouldn't condone it, and it should be condemned. But you know, unfortunately, when you have the media and the left crying that it's a crime, that it's treason, well, just sleazy politics, it seems relatively tame by comparison.
Definitely. I think Aaron talks about Trump willing to get into the gutter to win. And I think that's very important to point out, because it's his whataboutism that's appeared on the right, where it's basically gotten to, well, who cares if we collude with Hillary's that bad? I think it's really bad, because once Donald Trump legitimizes Russia as a friend and not someone we should be skeptical of, it causes the right to side with them, and it's going to create bad policy out of it. We've seen with the scandal, the Monica Lewinsky scandal, it completely changed the United States culturally, basically, with the Clinton administration saying that Clinton wasn't acting at all up and that what he was doing didn't constitute as sexual intercourse. And it basically changed how everyone viewed everything. And I think that's going to happen with Russia and on the right. And people aren't going to see Russia as the enemy, even though throughout the 20th century and the Cold War, the GOP stood up against the USSR and said, look, these guys are the enemies. We need to fight them. They're our greatest threat. And the GOP only dropped 3 elections in the latter half of the century because of it. And I think if the GOP is going to remove themselves from this principled stance, they're just going to hurt themselves, and they're going to look foolish, and they're going to look like the left, and everyone's just going to be worse off because of it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Rob here. And I think what people need to realize also in the context of what's going on, there was a lot of backtracking from the Trump administration about this whole thing. And I think that adds to the severity of what happened. And also, you could pretty much draw comparisons to Loretta Lynch's meeting with Bill Clinton. I mean, there is, okay, did something wrong happen? Really? who knows, nothing illegal technically happened, perhaps, but it was the appearance of impropriety that was at focus. So I think for Donald Trump Jr. to even accept that meeting with who he thought was a Russian official was at best improper. So I think that the whole context has to be taken into account, and we cannot engage in this kind of tribalism of automatically defending your own, even if something like this happens. You know, you have to take everything into account. So I just think there's a lot more to take into account. It was improper, illegal, who knows, but it was definitely, I think, improper.
Right. So I just want to be clear that this is Donald Trump Jr. doing this, and he was working directly for the campaign. So while kind of the whole idea of him meeting with a Russian lawyer to talk about potential Hillary intel, they didn't get that intel from what we can tell, but it definitely shows kind of the fact that Donald Trump Jr. was willing to collude. And that's might be close enough for the Democrats, close enough to a smoking gun that they've been looking for. It's not quite the smoking gun, but it's getting close.
I think what you're saying is very important, because when you talk about collusion, is collusion illegal? It isn't. And I could tell you this because Hillary and DNC colluded against Bernie Sanders in the DNC primary. It's not illegal. It is unethical. And I think that's where we need to look at what lines we're drawing here. Are we going to excuse unethical behavior because it's not illegal? I don't think the GOP should go down that road. I think Trump should take some measures here and remove his family from his whole entire administration. I think it would show that he's going to open up his administration to more transparency and more clarity towards the American people. And I think furthering this and saying that his son's going to be transparent and that everything's just going to come out, I think it's just going to widen the gap of trust between the left, which despise him already. I think even if it's a futile effort, I think Trump should move towards the left in a sense of, I'm going to try and rebuild trust with you, even if we disagree on everything. Because I think one thing that's been very clear is that there's been a lot of divisiveness in the last 6 months, and I think Trump has not done anything to stop from that contribution.
So I would just disagree slightly in that. I mean, I don't think what took place between Trump Jr. and this Russian attorney was collusion. Because even if she is a Russian government attorney, even if she did give him like dirt on Hillary, then all that shows that he's willing to take obviously research from anybody. That's certainly not collusion by any stretch. I'm not condoning it, obviously. I'm just saying that we need to be precise with what we're talking about here. But you know, as we were saying, also talking about collusion, you know, Hillary, the DNC and Hillary Clinton allies actually colluded with Ukraine for obtuse research on Donald Trump. So from a legal standpoint, that's no different than what Trump Jr. did with Russia. From a policy standpoint, I mean, it's probably arguable that what Trump Jr. did was worse, because he was talking to a foreign hostile actor, or at least intended to do so. But legally, I mean, they're on the same ground.
Yeah, and even if so, I do hear that a lot. People saying, "Well, Hillary did this," that doesn't necessarily make it right.
Right, and I'm not saying that it's right. All I'm pointing out is that because the people on the left are the ones saying, "Oh, Trump Jr. did it, is a crime," and so forth. And if they're going to argue that, then they have to also argue that what Hillary's allies did was a crime too. I'm saying both of them aren't a crime. I'm even saying that Trump Jr. what Trump Jr. did was probably worse. But I'm really pointing out how absurd that the left's cries of criminality are in this case.
Right. Okay. Yeah. In that case, yes, I absolutely agree. Yeah. I think I feel like the partisanship on both sides is hardening in both cases. So it's a matter of being reasonable and logical in approaching both of these cases with Hillary and Ukraine and Trump Jr. and the Russian lawyer, and looking at making a standard of what is improper and what is not, as opposed to, oh, this is right because our side did it, as opposed to the other side, because they did it, it's wrong. So I think that's the key thing to to look at here.
Now, I want to ask a little bit of a broader question. In this day and age, with you know the internet and various countries' ability to hack things, should we really be that concerned about foreign countries kind of trying to influence our elections? Because, I mean, without a doubt, the United States of America tries to influence just about every other country's elections to our favor as well. Like, there shouldn't be really any doubt about that. One letter agency or another is going to have some kind of program dedicated to that. So should we just kind of protect against it, but be ready and anticipating that a foreign government is going to be trying to influence our elections? Or should we, you know, kind of actively fight that and say, no, 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 if they did influence, we need to get rid of whoever they were trying to get to win and go with the other person?
I think we do have to protect ourselves from foreign influence, especially when we're talking about a hostile actor like Russia, because their whole point, they probably did want Trump in office. I could see the argument that they wanted Hillary instead, but the thing is, what their ultimate goal was trying to undermine our democratic process, basically. They want people to lose faith in our electoral institutions, and that's what we have to be afraid of here. And I'm sure, China has raised all kinds of cyber warfare against us, and they're stealing our technology. They've been involved, they were involved in that Office of Personnel and Management hack a couple of years ago. So I'm always surprised if China has at least tried to do more of the same, too. So I think you do, because of what these hostile actors want to try and do to us. As far as what we do to other countries, I think the distinction is that what countries like Russia and China want to do is they're trying to create chaos in our country. What we're trying to do is making sure that somebody who is aligned with our interests is in power in countries, say, like, let's hypothetically say Iraq. You know, it's like after we take out Saddam Hussein, I think we wanted somebody who was more aligned with our interests. You know, instead of having somebody else come in who would have been more of an enemy. That, as it turns out, you know, Nouri al-Maliki ends up being very close to Iran, which ended up being a mistake there. But the different point I'm trying to make, though, is the fact that when we interfere with we influence elections like that, it's because we want to make sure that some like totalitarian, who could be detrimental to our interests isn't in power. Whereas countries like Russia and China just want to create chaos.
And it's kind of a case-by-case basis with me. I mean, when you look at Nigel Farage, I'm pretty sure he's the leader of UKIP. He obviously liked Trump because Trump was a pretty big Brexit guy. So obviously, he liked the connection. He'd rather have Trump dealing with Brexit. Maybe he can have some positive influence for the Brexit people in Britain. And obviously, there's Putin, who's a pretty thuggish dictator who's willing to murder journalists. And I think that those are two different measurements. And I don't think I'm asking for relativism. I think I'm asking for principles to be applied in certain ways. Obviously, we got to be skeptical of what Britain wants and what Russia wants from us. And I think there's a different level of skepticism we take from Britain, who's been relatively kind and relatively friendly towards us throughout the whole entire 20th century and going into the 21st century. And obviously, there's Russia, who's been our foe ever since they became the USSR and ever since Putin came into office. And I think that we have to be careful on the world stage that we're not cozying up to people, regardless of whether we like them or not. We have to make sure we're firm in our stance, and America's always first. We're not going to co-op our power with anyone else, whether it be in the Middle East, Europe, or Asia. And I think going forward, I think Trump's going to have to make sure he draws a bunch of lines when it comes to Putin and when it comes to Britain, it comes to China, it comes to any other place. He has to make sure that he knows who's going to be in charge and that America's going to lead and that we're not going to cozy up and ask for information from anyone else.
Right. I think that's been a kind of a tone that the Trump administration has had ever since they started taking power in the U.S., whether it's with NATO, whether it's with Russia, there's kind of an ambiguity of leadership, whether or not, okay, well, you're cozying up to Russia a little bit, what do you really stand for? And I think that's overlooked when looking at the DNC and Ukraine. Why would the Ukraine do this? Well, maybe it's because Trump has been downplaying NATO, and Ukraine is under the immediate threat of Russia. So we kind of look at that as well in terms of the ambiguity of leadership here. You know, there's no real what direction are we going to? What is the stance of the United States? Are we still going to be friendly to NATO? Or are we still going to stand up to Russia? It's kind of ambiguous at this point, I think.
I certainly agree that there is some ambiguity there, and I think that is certainly worthy of concern. I think Ukraine's main deal was the fact that it was the fact that they were concerned about Paul Manafort, because Paul Manafort had ties to the guy's name was like Poroshenko. Basically that like the prior like Ukrainian leader who had ties to Putin basically, and that was who they were throwing dirt on. And now Manafort's not the campaign anymore. So with that said though, it does bother me that Trump has been kind of warm toward Putin, and I have been encouraged with some of his recent actions. Like he recently recommitted, reaffirmed America's commitment to Article 5 of NATO. He's also said he's going to sell Poland some missile defense systems, which is huge, in order to kind of be a deterrent against Putin. And of course, his airstrikes against Assad back in April were very good too. So I'm encouraged by that, but I mean, Trump still has shown a little bit of warmth toward Putin. I think it is worthy of concern, and as Rob was mentioning earlier, like I am concerned that many Republicans, being on the right, are starting to cozy up to Putin too, you know, because of tribalism and so forth. That's not good, because Putin was a mid-level KGB thug who wants to rebuild the Soviet Union. This is a bad dude we're talking about here. You know, being since. In addition to that, I mean, like, he's killed journalists, there are all these opposition leaders that have, like, died under, like, these mysterious circumstances. He's cozied up with enemies of ours, like Iran, Syria, Hugo Chavez, back when he was still alive, also cozied up to the Taliban, actually, recently, like, which we've been fighting against in Afghanistan. And they've also been a protector of Kim Jong-un, basically, too. A lot of these resolutions that would be detrimental to North Korea, like Russia blocks along with China. So in every respect, Putin is not our friend. He is an enemy, and we should all be concerned about him. And that's why we should be putting the pressure on Trump to not be warm towards him and do more of what I just mentioned earlier, which is, you know, reaffirming him into Article 5 and so forth. But we can't do that if something on our side are going to be tribalists and start warming up to Putin too.
All right. I think that about wraps it up for our Russia talk tonight. So next topic we'll be moving on to. This one might put some people to sleep, but it's pretty important. So we're going to be talking about net neutrality. And net neutrality is basically the phrase means traditionally that all internet sites would be on a neutral playing field, and no single site would have favor in the eyes of the internet service providers. So it's going to be a little bit difficult to talk about this. I want to make sure everyone's kind of using the same kind of phrasing and terms on this, just so everyone can get a clearer idea. So let's just start getting into it, and then we'll try and get some common ground on where we want to be using some phrases here that everyone can better understand. So first off, give us your initial thoughts on net neutrality.
So I think it's worth just, it's you talked about how it's important to understand the terminology here, so I just want to clear that up. So net neutrality, which you basically touched on, is basically it's the idea that these ISPs shouldn't be able to slow down or speed up traffic to certain sites to help one side or the other. Now, Title II, which is really the crux we're talking about here, is the notion that internet broadband has been reclassified from being under the Federal Trade Commission's jurisdiction to under the FCC's jurisdiction under the 1934 statute that classifies it in the same purview as, like, you know, telephone companies and TV companies and so forth. And so the Title II is the real issue here, because I think net neutrality is something we can all agree on. It's something where we all don't want, right? I mean, we don't want, you know, ISPs like speeding up or slowing down certain sites. We can all agree on that. It's Title II is the problem here. That's what I think, at least, because by putting it on the FCC's purview, you're basically opening up the internet to these scores of regulations from the FCC. So, for instance, under Title II, any new like technology or business model put forth by an up and coming ISP, or even an existing one, I mean, that's basically at the whim of the FCC. They're the ones who will decide if it goes into effect or not. And that would obviously slow things down. The SEC could also change its standards on a whim and also make things even more uncertain. But I think the most important thing is the fact that basically what Title II does is that it basically puts unaccountable, faceless bureaucrats in charge of the internet. And that's what my problem is, because I don't like the idea of the bureaucracy controlling something that's such a crucial part of our lives, basically. What's made the internet great is the fact that we've had a light touch regulatory aspect to it. That's what's caused it to thrive and so forth. And having it under the purview of Title II basically ruins that. So now, while I don't think that there's been enough net neutrality violations to even warrant that kind of reclassification, I would be in favor of Congress coming up with some legislation instead that addresses it and puts forth, you know, a clear consumer protection standard that the FTC, not the FCC, the FTC can enforce instead. I think is a much more viable solution, not having the FCC just control it at their whim.
I would have to disagree with you a little bit there, and I think the only way for me to go would be get regulation completely out of it. I think the best way to look at it is the internet has basically been untouched for the first 20 years of its creation, and I think that there's been no problems with it. We've seen Google's gone from this basic search engine to a place where we're having a hangout where there's one guy in the West Coast, one guy in the East Coast, one guy in Ohio, one guy in D.C. We're doing this perfectly fine in HD quality. I think there should be no reason why government should go in and regulate who gets to do what. If a website deserves a faster speed, the ISP should be able to provide it. If a website is not going to be as profitable or as helpful for the ISP, they should be able to slow it down a little bit. But I think this innovation allows them up, like Lone Conservative and Daily Wire, they're able to earn their own speeds and they're able to earn their own rights on the internet. And I think that's good. And I think when people like John Oliver talk about it, they say clearing the playing field, I mean, leveling the playing field, that's not right. Because when we talk about healthcare, we don't want a level playing field. We want a clear playing field where everyone from top 1% to low income can compete without any government getting in the way. And I think the same principle should be applied to the internet, where we could say a small website can compete just as much as a big website. And I think to close up, one thing that we should look at is that all the big websites are going after net neutrality in a positive sense. And I think we should be very wary of that, because these big websites know the regulation will not hurt them. And they know their up-and-coming competitors will be hurt by that, because they will not be able to innovate at the same speed they can when nameless, faceless bureaucrats can be lobbied to, and then the companies can receive preferential treatment in return. And I think very wary of letting the government control the internet the same way we are wary about the government controlling any other sector of the economy.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you there. And we've already seen a little bit of how something other than net neutrality can affect our internet. For example, our internet speed is not even in the top 10 in the world when it comes to that. South Korea is, I believe, the first. Denmark is the 10th. We don't even break that. And I think that, honestly, I think that is because of the effect that a lot of ISPs, internet service providers, have on the internet culture, on how it operates here in this country. And I fully agree that the internet is something that is not only essential to our lives nowadays, but is also essential to communication, which can be crucial in times of crisis. For example, in Venezuela, they have limited the access to internet, and any limit to the access of internet is, against potential free speech, free assembly, free anything really. So, I think anything against net neutrality is against what we want or stand for.
I take a little bit of a different stance on this. This is horrible for me. I have a nice Reagan sign sitting right here. I actually take a more moderate to even leftist stance on net neutrality. And this is coming, I am a computer science student, so I'm a little bit more aware of the kind of more technical side of how the internet works and runs, more than, just the average Twitter user, just for example. Carlos, you bring up an interesting thing saying that like South Korea and Denmark, they all have faster load times than us. Part of the reason for that is simply just country size. It's all about how much land there is. And I mean, America clearly has about as much land as you can get. So, I mean, there's two main nodes that most ISPs, internet service providers, run through on the East Coast, and that's Chicago and New York. West Coast, I believe it's Seattle, San Francisco, and there's one in Texas, if I'm correct. Maybe wrong on that. So there's the first problem. In America, there's just too much land to cover. The second problem is the ISPs themselves. So what you have is about five companies that control all of the internet service provided to the entire country. And that's Comcast, Time Warner, T-Mobile, Verizon, and AT&T. There might be a few other smaller ones in there, but basically they're all running off of the same towers. They all rent space on the same towers, or they own those towers specifically. And basically what most of the ISPs have done is gone around and agreed that, oh, we're just gonna have our company here and you guys can have the next city over, and then we'll have this city and then you guys can have that city. So there's little monopolies forming and there's no true competition because all of these companies are kind of colluding with each other to only own certain zones. Like I have a friend that lives literally 3 miles from me who can't get faster download speeds than, you know, six megabytes down just because he's in a different township and he can't get AT&T to his doorstep. That's a little bit ridiculous to me. The other thing is, because these ISPs control everything, they can control internet speeds for any website. We saw a court case where Netflix was suing, I believe it was Comcast, because they accused Comcast for throttling their internet speeds. And basically what that means is users trying to connect to Netflix's website would have slower speeds. Their load times would be longer just because Comcast said so. And what happened during this court case, while it was being resolved, you could actually track on a line. You can look up graphs for this. Track on a line, see Netflix speeds dropping for users who had Comcast, just absolutely plummeting. And then once that court case was resolved, their speeds bounced straight back up to where they were originally. So I think I'm, you know, as much against of government intervention as much as the next guy. I think Title II is a little far reaching, but personally, I believe that we need to have some kind of system in place that prevents these, you know, five internet service providers from just getting together and basically agreeing who can access what sites and when and for how much.
Well, yeah, I do agree with that, because I think that the ISP the ISP guys, internet service providers, they are taking advantage of the current system as much as they can, and that's I think why Google, who have been trying to get into markets where some of these ISPs have a good monopoly, why they've been getting a lot of resistance because of that. Because Comcast is here, and why is Google coming in and trying to set up this network, the internet network? So I do agree that there should be something that prevents a monopoly, basically, which is in the it should be the case in any industry where it tries to prevent that monopoly, but especially with the internet, I do agree with that.
Well, here's the thing, though. It's not just, you know, one big company keeping all the smaller companies out. It's all the big companies agreeing that, hey, we're not going to step on your turf. It's, you know, Comcast saying to AT&T, TNT, you can have that state, we'll have this state. And also, I just want to kind of point out that ISPs are about the most hated companies in America. like Time Warner Cable or Spectrum, whatever they call themselves now, is literally like number one on most hated lists of companies like in America. It's ridiculous that, you know, the companies that we have to rely on the most for our internet connections, for using Facebook, for using Google, for anything, is also has the worst rating of all time. And if people really kind of figured out how much it truly costs to move data to send a text message or anything, they would tear down the ISPs. If people knew how much they were overpaying for internet connectivity, they would lose their minds. Especially way back when people were paying, you know, cents on the text, 5 cents for one text. Even back then, what was it, around 2008 when that was still going on? That was ridiculous. If people knew how much they were overpaying, how little it cost to send a few bits of characters over the airwaves.
I think what you point out is very important when you talk about these states trying to, these companies rather, the ISPs splitting up states. I think that's where you have to nip the problem in the bud here. And the problem with the companies are monopolies. Obviously, a free market can't have a monopoly, because when it comes to competition and when it comes to supply and demand, one company cannot successfully supply the whole market unless there's some form of government intervention or some force that's basically allowing this company to stay by itself, or by the companies able to collude, like you said. And I think one thing we could do is we could look and see what regulations are allowing these ISPs to stay just big, large international conglomerates as the way they are. And I think moving forward, we should stop looking at the end result and looking at the cause of the problem. And I think moving forward on the internet, I think what we're doing is just fine right now. I think even some net neutrality getting rid of, in my opinion, it's worth trying to deal with other issues. I think you bring up great points, even though I do disagree and you disagree with me. I think you understand a little more than I. But I think one thing moving forward we can do is we can find a way to kind of break up these big monopolies, these big trusts that control the internet, because I think the speeds can get faster, like you said, with your friend who's just, by the way he lives, should not be having the force for lower download speeds than you. And I think moving forward, we should always try and find the way to improve everyone's internet speed, because I think the internet is the wave of the future. And if everyone can have equal access in a sense that they're not being discriminated against for their location, then we can't move forward as a equal society in a sense.
Right. So, I do agree that there are some good points brought out there. I should probably mention, though, that a lot of these instances that you brought out there, Alec, tend to be kind of few and far between, a little more isolated. I'm not saying that they excuse it. I'm just saying that they tend to be more outliers. So all I'm saying there is that doesn't mean we should be, like, totally changing we should be totally fundamentally transforming the internet under Title II classification. As far as monopolies go, we do have antitrust laws in place. I don't necessarily like them, although I think they have some value. They could be of value when it comes to breaking up unions. But because of monopolies, I kind of take Milton Friedman's stance, which is basically the idea that the best way to fight against monopolies is free trade. It's capitalism. Because the thing is that in free markets, like, if you have monopolies, they're only temporary, typically. And they eventually fall back down, because ultimately a monopoly's model is unsustainable. And in a free market, eventually some other company is going to take advantage of the unsustainable model, and then that monopoly falls apart. And so Milton Friedman, he actually asked, this was a question posed to him, actually, by someone else at monopolies. And Milton Friedman asked this question. He said, like, how many monopolies can you think of that actually say monopolies, you know, without government intervention? And Milton Friedman said he can only think of, like, two. I think one of them was New York Stock Exchange, because that's kind of its own unique thing. Then it was Southern National Diamond Company. So what keeps monopolies in place is government regulation. And ironically, as Rob mentioned earlier, it's the ISPs that like net neutrality. Because net neutrality goes into place, actually, it helps them. It helps them maintain their monopoly, you know? So I think the free market can handle this. If they are colluding, I think that kind of collusion is illegal. But because I think collusion in general, like when it comes to monopolies, it is an illegal thing. But that's why I did say that if Congress were to pass a clear consumer standard that maintains a light touch of regulation on the internet, there's still a way for consumers to kind of fight back in case an ISP is screwing them over. You know, I would be fine with that. I just don't think that having the FCC control everything at their whim, have faceless, unaccountable bureaucrats control the entire internet, I think that's wrong.
All right. Well, I'm glad that we could have that discussion. We're actually kind of running over our time tonight, so we're going to have to cut it there. Thank you for joining us, everybody. It's been an absolutely fantastic night. I've really enjoyed our talks here. So, Aaron, why don't you start us off? Tell us where we can find you online.
Well, first you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Bandler's Banter. I know it's kind of long, so it's my last name, Bandler, B-A-N-D-L-E-R. And the Bandler is Banter, B-A-N-T-E-R. You can follow me there. You can also see my articles at Daily Wire. That's dailywire.com. I post like 4 or 5 stories on average a day. So be sure to read my stuff there. It's pretty good. So.
All right. Carlos, where can we find you at?
So on Twitter, my handle is at Chuck E. Chavez, C-H-A-V-E-S, not with a Z, not Hugo. I'm on there. I do contribute to the local conservative, so you can find some of my stuff on there too.
Rob?
And I'm on Twitter at Real Robert Sasso, and I also contribute for local conservative, and I'm the host of the Campus Conservative podcast, so everyone go check that out.
Definitely check out that podcast, Rob, with the Twitter handle change there. A little bit easier to find you now. And as always, I am your host, Alex Sears. You can find me at SearsAL on Twitter and on Lone Conservative. Thank you all for watching. Have a good night.